On winter's night of power, the comrades first shall meet. The princess of the woodlands, the scion of watchmen bright, the child of dwarves and fairies, the giant from the east, the son of fallen Simia, the outcast from the pack, the wizard of the shattered coast, though present yet unseen. Together will they forge man's fate, together stand against the storm, for when they find the light of yore, shall ancient darkness wake once more. Merry Christmas. Welcome to the Energemetra 6 podcast. We have a bit of a special episode for you today. Winter Night is a story that I wrote about 15 years ago. It's somewhere between the length of a novel and a novella, something just over a two-hour read, all said and done. And we thought it would be just about perfect for the season and for a sort of a different show to bring you. Not exactly live, because we're all at home with our families spending time today. So I hope you enjoy our Christmas special at Energemetra 6. This is Winter Night by Jared Misha. Prologue. The inn nestled among the giant trees of the forest, its seasoned timbers and weathered stone a reminder of old times and old storms, now long gone and forgotten. The black of night pressed close to the ancient structure, its thatch covered in a heavy blanket of fine white snow. The snow still fell, and despite the canopy of surrounding trees, the wind whipped it about until its descent was more horizontal than vertical at times. It was the sort of night in which finding shelter was the first concern of anyone unlucky enough to be caught out in the raging storm. Inside, a fire crackled brightly in the hearth, its orange hues vivid against the dingy backdrop of soot-stained plaster walls and the dark furniture of the common room. The room, however, was far warmer than the wind, which, as if to prove the point, howled around the eaves and across the chimney. Several groups of guests huddled around the room, talking little and laughing not at all. A wary, oppressive silence hung about the place, making conversation seem an uneasy business at best, despite how much busier the inn was than usual. An old man sat at a table by the fire in a rickety wooden chair, dozing with his long white beard on his chest and a tobacco-stained pipe hanging loose in his jaws. The other occupants unlucky enough to be caught in the storm, travelers all huddled in small groups, whispering among themselves occasionally. Only a few were unusual enough to catch the eye. Three trolls sprawled at a low table in one corner, watching the room with hooded eyes, while in the opposite corner, by the door, a lone figure reclined, feet propped on a chair with the hood of a finely woven cloak pulled low over his eyes. The rest of the patrons were obviously locals, their clothing homespun, their features weathered. By the hearth, the old man shifted, making his chair creak just as the wind gave an especially loud howl. Awakened by the noise, he started, then shivered uneasily and looked around as the wind howled again. He sighed and started to close his eyes again, but the door opened, letting in a blast of freezing air and snow. A moment later, three cloaked figures stepped through, stamping the snow off their boots and closing the door behind them. Heads turned as people sought the source of the cold, but a moment later attention returned to their own various companies. Even newcomers didn't rouse much curiosity. As the scant conversation resumed, two of the inn's occupants seemed to shrink back into the darkness in the corner furthest from the door. The three newcomers, their faces hidden in the shadows of their cloaks, conferred for a moment, then picked their way through the room to where the old man sat watching them, with a half-open eye. When they reached his table, they stopped, with the tallest of the three facing him, the other two flanking their leader, their eyes raking the occupants of the room. The leader spoke, his voice low.
May we sit down, old one?
The old man considered for a moment, then asked,
Who claims your sword, stranger?
The three shifted away from the table a bit, and the leader sneered.
That is a dangerous question, old one.
The old man shrugged.
Age teaches one not to fear questions. This inn is a freehold. Sit where you like.
The leader nodded, and the three quickly seated themselves in the remaining chairs around the old man's table, their motions fluid. The old man seemed about to speak, but their leader asked,
What news is there in this place?
The old man stared into the fire for a moment, putting up a hand to stroke his beard, then chuckled.
You ask dangerous questions, Dark One. But news? I don't know that there is news. Though...
He twitched his shoulders in a shrug.
There are always stories.
Yes?
The newcomer's voice, still low, had taken on a sharper quality, and his eyes shone with shocking brilliance from the depths of his hood, seeming to bore into the old man, who raised his bushy eyebrows, looking faintly amused.
Rumor has war in the south. They say the King of Drusk has sworn vengeance upon the Jahazi trolls of the Great Plain. There was something about a lost hunting party, I think, but I don't pay much attention to such. By the time the news gets here, it's almost as old as I am.
He made a throwaway gesture with the hand that was not holding his pipe. The newcomer scanned the room again.
I see,
he murmured, sounding faintly disappointed. The old man turned his eyes again upon the leader, and this time his voice had a slight edge.
Now tell me, who claims your sword, stranger?
One of the man's companions cursed and reached for his belt, but the leader raised a hand to halt him.
You will do yourself harm, old one. You must know that men are killed for asking another's allegiance. The oath is both enemy and friend to any of us. Still...
He shrugged.
My sword is my own. I owe no allegiance.
In that case...
The old man fixed his gaze on the newcomer's face, still hidden in the strange shadows of his hood, as if seeking a reaction.
There are rumors of strange doings in the mountains as well.
Doings?
The stranger's voice regained its odd note, and he resumed his former piercing stare. The old man shrugged.
They say weremen have been seen in the North Holds. They say a deep shadow has fallen over the mountains, gathering up all the dark things of the netherworld. If the rumors are true, the creatures hide there, awaiting their master's return so they can claim the world for their own. And for those who believe such things, they say the star of yore shines once more.
The stranger hissed, the sound of a long breath drawn in between clenched teeth, and said, half in question, half in demand,
Who has told you such tales? What do you know?
The old man hesitated.
Well...
Then he shook his head as if pushing an idea away.
No.
He muttered under his breath. Then he reiterated a little louder.
No.
As if he had decided some question in his own mind. The stranger seized his arm.
What have you heard? Tell me.
The old man paused and stared pointedly at the stranger's hand, which clutched demandingly at his arm. In response, the hand was slowly withdrawn, and the old man turned his gaze to the fire once again, saying nothing for a long moment. When he next spoke, his voice was distant, as if he pondered a place far away or a time long past.
It was a traveler who told me. A strange man who seemed to wear the silence as a cloak. He shared my fire for a night. I've never heard the like of the tale he told, even from of old. It seems fanciful beyond belief. Such fancies are too big a mouthful for this modern world. When children no longer believe in weremen or giants.
He snorted softly.
But.
He twitched his shoulders in another shrug.
If he spoke true, we may see the signs of the ancient times once again.
His eyes unfocused slightly, and he seemed to be gazing inward for a moment to something unseen by the rest of the world. Then he began his story.
Chapter 1. She stood motionless on the edge of the clearing, hood pulled low over her eyes, listening. The forest around her was as dark and still as she, the trees sending searching branches into the night. The moon above her shone bright above the woodland's canopy, which spread to the south and west as far as the eye could see. Very near to the north and sweeping around into the distance to the east, a wall of mountains rose, huge and forbidding, into the sky. Strange, terrible fortresses of black stone, guarded by dark, purplish clouds that swallowed up their peaks. Seen from the corner of the eye, the clouds seemed to creep further and further outward from the mountains, as if they wished to consume the sky itself. If one turned to look at them directly, however, they still hovered there, churning slowly. The wind stirred the trees, whispering through the branches and brushing lightly over the cloak shrouding the solitary figure on the hillside, still standing unmoving in the darkness. There was something wrong with the air, with the night itself. Something was present that should not be there, she thought. Or possibly something was missing. She wasn't certain, and that in itself was a bad sign. She had walked the forests of Eschaton for far longer than anyone from most of the world's races had ever lived. She knew the forests well, even this dark, unnatural one. Again the breeze brought the scent of the woods to her nose, and again she sensed the almost imperceptible tang of bitterness, of something wrong. Yet, as she tried to isolate it in her mind, it disappeared again. Behind her, the trees stirred, and she turned to see her companion emerge from their shadow. He stalked toward her, eyes flicking around the clearing.
My Lady Talina, the path ahead is clear, and...
His eyes swept the clearing again, uneasily.
Something is wrong with this wind.
Yes, Bretrin, I feel it. We must be getting close. Perhaps closer than we'd like.
He frowned.
This is no time for second thoughts. If you would go back...
No, of course not.
Talina waved her hand dismissively.
This is an uneasy night, and we haven't yet found...
Bretrin cut in. His hard face set itself into grim, determined lines that had become more and more familiar of late.
We must continue. That path is set now.
Suddenly, Talina's hand shot up, and her head whipped to the right toward the edge of the clearing. With her gesture, Bretrin melted back into the shadows as if he had never been, his hand already moving to the hilt of his sword. Talina's breath hissed as she inhaled. Then she turned and stepped quickly back into the forest. The leaves on the trees, still but for the wind, began to tremble slightly, as if the earth were shaking imperceptibly. It grew more and more as the seconds passed, and a sound came, faint at first, then louder and louder, like thunder gathering in the distance and rolling in through the darkness. Then the thunder became a roar, and a shape broke through the trees on the southeastern side of the clearing. It was moving impossibly fast, but its features were unmistakable, even in the dimness. It was a horse of a kind both beautiful and terrible. Its black coat shone with magic, and its mane streamed straight out behind it from the terrific speed at which it ran. Red lightning flashed in its eyes, and light danced around its hooves as it struck sparks from the earth, whether it trod upon stones, grass, or the softest earth.
Talina had seen a dread steed once before, when she was very young. And this was a stallion of the kind that belonged only to the fair folk. It seemed to freeze for a moment before her eyes, and she caught a profile both noble and infinitely dangerous, perfect of form and limb, its rider seeming impossibly small upon its back. Talina shrank even further back into the shadows as it thundered across the clearing, a blur of speed, hooves beating the earth. Behind it came the terrifying avalanche of the wild hunt, all hooves and whips and phalites, red and black leather flashing as it pounded past through the darkness. Along with the dread steeds came the dark hounds. They were creatures of nightmare, the larger cousins of the great forest wolves, bred magically for the hunt, their eyes and teeth glittering as they followed fast on the heels of their master's steeds. Once it began, the parade of shapes and lights and eyes racing through the gloom seemed to go on forever, and Talina stood absolutely still, barely breathing. Hundreds of horses and riders fairly flew through the clearing each moment, but they just kept coming. As Talina watched, the night was broken by a cry from the darkness, and two shapes sailed out of the mass of horsemen to land rolling in the grass on the near side of the clearing. Then, as quickly as the careening cavalcade had begun, it simply ended, and the ground was still, but for a little residual trembling that soon faded to nothing. There was no sign at all that the hunt had passed. Not a blade of grass was bent, and the trees were as still and silent as ever. All that remained were two inert shapes lying in the grass.
Merry Christmas, everybody. I couldn't think of a good way to say this, so I'm just going to spill it. Basically, I desperately need to grow my audience. So I appreciate financial support. I appreciate folks buying my books. But the most critical thing you can do if you want me to be able to keep doing this is to share it with someone you think might appreciate it. A friend, a relative, whatever. I really need more people, more eyes, more interest in the Energemetra 6 project. And if you want to do me a favor, whatever you can manage to that end really is the best thing you can do. So I want to say thank you and Merry Christmas, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Two. Talina stood absolutely still, watching. There was a good chance that when the leader of the hunt realized he had lost two of his hunters, he would return for them. The folk were a reclusive lot, but for the hunt and the snatchers, and seeing even those was a rarity. They would not knowingly leave two of their own among the hostile outsiders, but the folk were only human, just as any of the races of man. They were just as likely to err. Seconds stretched into long silent minutes as Talina waited, totally still but for her breathing. Finally, after what must have been a full quarter of an hour, one of the two figures before her stirred and moaned. A moment later it sat up and looked blearily around. In the silver light of the full moon, Talina could see it was a girl, and a rather tiny one, as would have been expected for the folk. She would have been under 4 lengths high, standing upright. That was short even for one of the folk. She turned her head side to side for a moment, then gave a muffled cry and started toward the other figure, still sprawled across the damp grass of the clearing. As the girl moved forward to hover over the still form, Talina stepped silently from the trees. Talina was a gray shadow in the silver moonlight of winter night, moving through the clearing, her cloak's colors matching her surroundings with a little too much accuracy for the eye to be comfortable. Approaching the two, she could see that the one on the ground was a boy, and entirely too large for one of the folk. Talina let out a short, surprised hiss of breath, and the girl whipped around, coming instantly from her knees into a defensive crouch over her companion, eyes shining in the moonlight. Talina halted, surprised. Her little breath should not have been audible even a few lengths away. The girl made a grab for something inside her cloak, and she seemed almost frantic as Talina raised a hand in something between greeting and caution.
"Who are you?"
Uttered in a voice of tinkling silver bells, the girl's challenge was strong enough to carry clearly, and the warning in it was unmistakable, yet still soft enough not to be heard beyond the edge of the clearing. Talina's eyebrows rose. Such control and purpose were impressive, considering the circumstances. That was especially true if this was only a child. It could be hard to tell with the folk.
"Peace, girl. I've nothing against you."
There was a noise of crackling brush from across the clearing, and Bretron stepped from the shadow of the trees, his sword drawn. The girl whipped around, her hand coming out of her cloak to reveal a dagger, held cocked and ready to throw.
"Drop it."
Bretron's words slammed into the still night like a granite boulder, and the girl hesitated, her arm still, staring across the clearing at the tall man, his chainmail gleaming dully under the moon, his sword an accusing finger of steel pointed straight at her. The two held there, frozen for long moments, until, slowly, the girl replaced the half-drawn knife within her cloak. Talina had moved silently up until she stood barely five lengths behind the Fey child and the Degani boy. Degani he was. Talina could see him clearly now, sprawled in a tangle of limbs across the grass, his chest rising and falling ever so slightly. Talina spoke gently, and the girl turned back to her.
"What is your name, child of the folk?"
"Sirith."
The girl stared suspiciously up at her, still hovering protectively over the unconscious boy on the ground.
"What do you want?"
Talina raised an eyebrow.
"From you? Likely nothing."
Her eyes considered the Fey child for a long moment.
"Would you have us leave you as we found you? Cast-offs of the hunt?"
Sirith started to nod almost belligerently, then brought herself up short and looked down at the boy, who had begun to stir feebly.
I don't know."
The boy opened his eyes, and Sirith threw herself upon his neck, hugging him fiercely.
"Oh, Malachi, are you all right?"
He groaned and reached up to hug her in return, then set her easily on her feet as he stood up. He was nearly as tall sitting as she was standing. Seeing Talina, his eyes narrowed, but he remained silent, simply studying her for a long time. Talina returned his gaze, her face revealing nothing in the moonlight. There was a depth to his eyes, she saw. It was a depth that no child should have. It reminded her of... Talina frowned as Bretron approached, interrupting her train of thought. He was still watching the children carefully, though he had sheathed his sword. In a clipped, irritated voice, he said,
"What now? We can't take them with us. Not there."
He jerked a thumb toward the mountains to the north. Talina raised her eyebrow.
"Oh? We must take them with or send them back alone. And one is just as dangerous as the other."
Bretron nodded.
"But what about..."
Talina raised a hand to stop him, an odd expression on her face.
"Hold a moment."
She turned to the boy.
"Who are you?"
His slight frown was as thoughtful as his previous glance had been.
"I am Malachi. Who might you be, my lady elf?"
Talina frowned. Her kind were rare across Eschaton. She would never have expected one so young to recognize her, especially a Degani. Using the formal Aelf was just another surprise. Most used the more common pronunciation of Elf. This boy was quite a puzzle.
"I am Talina, Nial Kalin Nial in Kalith."
Malachi nodded gravely, and Talina thought she caught a glint of amusement in his eye. Talina glanced to Bretron, then turned and faced the two squarely. The Fey girl had moved to stand half behind the boy, obviously deferring to him. Though she remained silent as Talina spoke, her eyes never wavered.
You may join us on our journey if you wish. We travel north to the mountains. Otherwise, there's a town, Findale, 3 days south. We can give you food and water. If circumstances were different, we would accompany you, but we cannot.
At the word mountains, Malachi's eyes narrowed, but he shook his head.
Please, don't leave us. This is a terrible place, dangerous to folk, both fair and deep.
Talina's lips curved wryly.
The forest is dark, true, but the mountains are the source of the darkness. You would join us there?
Her tone was dry.
Safety lies to the south, boy, not in the Madra Risa.
Malachi shrugged as Cirith shifted uncomfortably behind him.
Yet it is to the dark mountains that you travel, lady. Surely we would be safe with you.
The neutrality of Talina's tone was its own sort of shrug.
Very well. Come then. Our horses are over the hill.
She motioned the children toward the southern edge of the clearing. There were four horses. Two were common pack animals, only lightly burdened. The other two were saddled for riding and obviously far from ordinary. One was a mare. Her color, an eye-twisting combination of gray and brown, seemed to fade into the foliage. The other was a pure white stallion, standing with head held high, intelligent eyes watching the trees suspiciously. It seemed he too disliked something about the place. It was the work of moments to move the remainder of their supplies to a single pack horse and rig a makeshift bridle so the children could ride. They had to ride bareback, but it didn't seem to bother them. They clung to the horse and each other as if they'd been born to it. After Talina mounted the mare and Bretron the stallion, the little party moved out toward the mountains. Talina led, sitting erect in the saddle, hood pulled low, alert to any change in the forest around her. Next were the children, holding on to the pack horse and saying little, staring into the woods as if they expected terrible creatures to plunge out of the brush at any moment and attack them. Bretron took up the rear, leading the remaining pack horse, his eyes flicking about, senses alert. Talina headed them straight for the mountains that towered so near to the north, following a ghost of a path that was invisible to the others at times. As they rode, the night seemed to wear on forever, the moon never moving from its place behind them, the entire world silent as the grave. Ahead, the mountains loomed ever closer, towering peaks still lost in the clouds. It must have continued that way, the horses' hooves making little crunching sounds in the needles of the forest floor, the saddles creaking slightly for several hours. Time, though, seemed to stand still. The breeze died, leaving the world frozen in the darkness, unmoving and silent. Chapter 3. As they continued, their surroundings became increasingly threatening. The trees' branches seemed to reach out for them, and the silence that had at first seemed merely eerie grew more and more ominous. All the while, Talina continued to catch stronger and stronger scent of whatever wrongness she had first become aware of in the clearing. Irritatingly, she still wasn't able to identify it. After a long enough time to leave them all in a near trance, Talina spoke, breaking the spell the night had held them under.
How did a Degani boy come to be in the company of the Fae, and riding the hunt no less?
She didn't turn her head, and after her voice faded, she might almost never have spoken. A moment later, Cirith asked,
Why should we tell you anything?
Her voice was high and musical, despite the belligerence of her message. Seemingly ignoring her, Talina said,
Cirith, an interesting name. What is your lineage, girl?
Cirith started, almost losing her hold on Malachi, who glanced back at her reassuringly. Cirith gulped. Talina turned her horse abruptly, facing them and making them pull their mount back sharply. Bretron also halted, watching everything and focusing on nothing, just as impassive as before. Talina stared out from the depths of her hood, and despite the shadows shrouding her features, a hint of reproof marred her calm.
There is more to this than you know, girl. Do not try my patience.
Cirith seemed to shrink in the saddle behind Malachi, but she spoke up indignantly, apparently unfazed.
Why do you get to ask all the questions? As if we were hiding something and you aren't. Yet here you are with him, and now us. You didn't even seem surprised to see us. You go first.
Talina shot an amused glance at Bretron.
You speak the truth. Elves do not trust easily, or ride with those whose loyalties are in question.
She nodded.
Yes, there is much to tell, and you too may have a part to play in this drama.
She shrugged and turned her horse, starting again along the path. It was a long moment before she began to speak.
My journey began when I was barely a child. An old man spoke a prophecy over me, which he said would change the world. Ever after that, I felt drawn to leave my people and wander. It began when I was barely 50 turnings. I went westward, then south. I returned to my people often in those early days. I would spend a turning at home, then another traveling. As time passed, I was away for longer and longer. Wandering became my life. I saw the four corners of the land and even sailed out from the shores of this land and saw another, far away. Of late, my travels have taken me to Dagon.
She paused, considering, and her tone was wry when she continued.
Wandering can become a way of life, and so it was for me. I had forgotten my childhood, lost much of what tied me to my people.
She paused again, then looked back as she spoke once more.
I had forgotten, until I heard that same prophecy again in Dagon. It was as if a voice had reached up from the depths of my past and pointed the way north. Bits of that riddle had been handed down by my people from generation to generation, ever since the Great War. I still do not know how it came to Dagon, and I heard it purely by chance, but it awoke old memories.
Talina peered through the darkness at the two children.
What do you know of Dagon?
Cirith's tone was more relaxed now as she said,
The stories say it is the land of the Dagani, the men who hold the north against the forces of darkness.
Bretron snorted softly, and Talina's gentle yet somehow bitter laughter rippled back to them.
Yes, that is what the stories say. And once it was even true. Today, the reality of the thing is a different matter. Once the Dagani may have been men of valor and courage who stood against the darkness. Now, the tale of the Northlands is much more interesting. The Dagani are warriors still, but they squabble among themselves like children, while their people are slaughtered or enslaved.
Bretron grunted. And this time when Talina laughed, her bitterness was plain, and she replied as if to his grunt.
Oh, you know the truth of it.
She waved her hand in a throwaway gesture that, at the same time, indicated Bretron.
He was having difficulties with one of his brothers over who would succeed their father as king. So when the reports they had been receiving about bandits and raids in this area began coming from sources too reputable for his father's regency council to ignore, he came north to see for himself. When we arrived in Findale, we found the barracks at half muster. The men had deserted their posts, and the farmers in outlying lands have not been heard from in months. There were also strange tales passing between the villagers. We decided to continue north to find the source of the problem. Despite some...
Her mouth quirked.
Trouble with the captain of the guard.
Cirith nodded, frowning.
There are only two of you.
Talina's voice carried contempt now.
We'd no royal authorization to take men from the barracks. Besides, I've my own suspicions of what has been happening here.
And your prophecy? What has it to do with all this?
Talina looked thoughtful. and her voice had a testing edge to it when she next spoke.
What is tonight, girl?
Cirith blinked, uncomprehending.
Winter night. There's only enough free magic for an easy hunt on winter night.
Talina's shoulder twitched under her cloak.
So it is.
And her voice changed, deepening as she continued, ringing out through the darkness.
On winter's night of power, the comrades first shall meet. The princess of the woodlands, the scion of watchmen bright, the child of dwarves and fairies, the giant from the east, the son of fallen Simia, the outcast from the pack, the wizard of the shattered coast, though present yet unseen. Together will they forge man's fate, together stand against the storm. For when they find the light of yore, shall ancient darkness wake once more.
Talina let the last words trail off into silence. Cirith's puzzled frown showed her incomprehension.
So the prophecy is speaking of tonight? But what does it mean? What darkness?
Talina's cool, ironic smile could be heard in her voice.
If I knew, I would hardly be bumbling around the forest in the middle of the night with two children, would I? All I know is that the prophecy was made by one of great power, one who should be believed, and we may have a part to play in its fulfillment.
Cirith nodded slowly, then asked,
But why me? My people are fey, but I'm not even grown yet.
Talina looked at Bretran, and, voice troubled, she said,
Prophecies have been wrong before, even those kept by my people. But that prophecy comes from the Book of Yore. The great wizard himself wrote it, shortly after the last terrible battle.
They were climbing into the foothills now, and Talina was guiding her mare carefully up a slope covered with rocks and loose debris. She fell silent for a moment, choosing their path, and Cirith asked,
The Book of Yore?
Talina looked back at her.
Do the Fae remember nothing of the past? I speak of the greatest warrior wizard of all time who defeated the Baizimyani, the Nameless One, in the Battle of Ages. He left a book of prophecy behind him when he left Eschaton. And this is the first and possibly greatest of the prophecies of Eschaton.
Suddenly, the air was rent by a terrible sound. Half howl, half scream, filling the night around them, echoing off the mountain ahead and raising the hair on the backs of their necks. The pack horse and the children's mount tried to bolt, but Bretran grabbed for the halter of the children's horse and held it. The pack horse's lead rein, however, which he had held in his other hand, slipped free, and the animal went crashing off into the brush. Bretran cursed.
Beastmen!
Chapter 4. Talina shot a disbelieving glance at Bretran, then her mouth curved into a speculative, ironic smile.
The outcast from the pack?
Screams sounded again, three this time, and she grimaced.
And the rest of the pack, it seems.
Whirling her horse, Talina called,
Come!
Then she whispered something to the mare, and it took off to the west at a dead run. Bretran slapped the children's horse on the rump, and, putting spurs to his own mount, followed Talina. A moment later, another scream tore through the night. This one, however, came from directly ahead. Talina scarcely paused, pulling her horse back around in a tight turn. But before Bretran and the children could follow, two more screams came in rapid succession from the south and the west. Talina turned once more, this time northeast. And again they began to run, all three horses abreast. As they fairly flew toward the mountains, dodging trees, they heard another scream behind them, this time of a horse in mortal agony, cutting off as abruptly as it had begun. Then the inhuman sounds came once more, this time in a chorus that set the horses running even harder than before. They raced on and on, each moment seeming an eternity. Their horses blowing now, tiring more with every step. They were running uphill with the unnatural black mountains looming just ahead of them, closer than ever, jutting up suddenly out of the land. All around, the trees hung motionless. Neither bird nor beast was to be seen. The chase dragged on for what could have been minutes or hours, and through it all, Talina seemed to be muttering something under her breath. Every now and then, either she or Bretron would glance behind them, but mostly they fixed their gazes ahead. Again, screams came from behind them and to either side, and Bretron and Talina exchanged meaningful looks. They were being herded like sheep to a slaughter, and the children must have known it too, judging by the glances they shot over their shoulders and the frightened way they peered ahead into the darkness. After a while, they began to see patches of snow, brilliant white in the darkness, and at times they plunged through drifts of the stuff, soft and powdery. They were under the clouds now, and soon they passed into shadow, leaving behind what little light the moon had provided. They were still running, though they hadn't heard the screams for some time, and Talina was still muttering to herself. Then the chorus of screams came again, and a few moments later there was a crashing in the forest to their right, as if a great beast was blundering toward them through the brush. Bretron's sword cleared its sheath in an instant, and its steel glinted in what little light penetrated into the shadow of the terrible clouds. The horses were running full out, foam flecking their bodies, and still the crashing sound came closer. The trail they had been following widened suddenly, and a great shape, at least twice the height of a man, broke from the brush next to them, running parallel to their course, but less than 50 lengths away. The screams sounded yet again, and the great running figure seemed to leap ahead of them along the trail, only getting closer to them as the trail began to narrow again. Then the screams sounded again, but this time deeper and closer than before. Their pursuers no longer called a hunt. Now they sounded the chase. Talina was still muttering to herself, but even more frantically now, and she suddenly veered off to the left in what appeared to be solid growth. As they all came to see, it was merely a thin screen of brush, and without warning they broke from the trees into the open. Ahead of them and off to the left was a cliff that dropped sheer into darkness, doubtless all the way to the forest below. Directly ahead lay a narrow trail along the mountain, with the cliff to one side and the steep mountainside to the other. Instead of heading along the mountain, Talina made for the brush to the right, stopping next to the mountainside just at the edge of the brush. Instantly, she was on the ground and pushing through the thicker brush that grew up along the slope. It only took a moment for her to find what she was looking for, but then she hissed and motioned Bretron forward. He swung from his horse and strode forward to where she stood. She pointed to the side of the mountain and spoke a few words. He nodded and pushed his body into the foliage, still leading his stallion. A moment later there was muffled cursing from ahead, but as the stallion disappeared, Talina motioned for the two children to dismount, and hurriedly pushed them after Bretron. She herself followed immediately behind them, leading her mare. As they pushed into the cave, they found that the entrance was just large enough for the horses to pass through, though after a few lengths it widened and the ceiling stretched away and upward into the darkness. The darkness was not complete, however. A glow lay ahead and off to the left, and when they halted they could see a tiny fire against the wall. Talina pushed her horse up beside them, and, almost reflexively, the children turned to look at the mouth of the cave. Cirith shrieked. A huge man was just getting to his feet where the cave's entrance started to widen. At 18 or 20 lengths tall, he could easily have been the monstrous shape they'd seen outside. Long, wild hair and beard flowed from a face that was broad, weathered, and knobbed like a great water-worn lump of volcanic rock. The eyes were massive blue and green orbs that caught the firelight and gathered it up like the eyes of a giant cat. Their colors, however, were not fixed. They changed and flowed with their gathered light, always running blue or green, with an occasional touch of yellow. At Cirith's scream, Talina spun and put her hand across the girl's mouth, muffling the greater part of the sound. She hissed,
"By the great king himself, be silent, girl. You'll kill us all."
Cirith raised a trembling hand and pointed at the huge figure, now standing at the entrance. Whatever she might have said was muffled by Talina's hand, but the elf responded anyway.
Yes, I know what he is. He is as caught here as we. Besides, this confirms it all.
As Cirith blinked up at her in shock, Talina released the fey girl and pushed past the two children toward the tiny fire where Bretron stood, his sword against the neck of what must have been the ugliest creature they had ever seen. It was short and squat, literally as wide as it was tall, with green-black skin that had odd tufts of hair poking out here and there. It wore only a breechcloth and long-sleeved robe, open at the front, hem brushing the dirt. Its arms and legs poked out at the corners of its body, almost like they had been added as afterthoughts. Its half-reptilian face was pocked and pebbled, and it shone with oil in the firelight. Talina spoke, quietly but with the same cool authority she had shown so far.
We are not safe here, but we should have a few moments. Say what you must, but by the star, do it quietly.
Everyone stared at her in varying mixtures of shock and befuddlement. They all stood inside the cave, firelight flickering around them, not a sound coming from any of them, except when one of the horses would stomp or snort. The raw fear of the chase still held most of them, and their minds were sluggish enough, even had there not been a great deal about their circumstances that was new to all of them. After a moment, as if she could not sense their confusion, Talina gestured gracefully to the great shape in the entrance to the cave.
Who might you be, my lord giant?
The figure stepped forward, away from the entrance and further into the fire's meager light. The giant was at least twice as tall as Talina, and in the confines of the cave, he had to stoop to keep his head from scraping the ceiling. He wore a loose brown cloak made of coarse wool cloth, unevenly dyed. Under the robe were trousers of the same rough weave, belted with a length of rope. In his hand he clutched a long staff, at least as tall as he was, for he held it at an angle, and it was still in danger of bringing down chunks of cave rock on their heads. It occurred to Cirith to wonder how he had gotten it into the cave with him, or how he had gotten in himself, for that matter. He must have crawled through the entrance nearly on his belly. The giant nodded to Talina and spoke in a voice that was deep, rumbling through the cave, even though he was obviously trying to be quiet.
Olgoth is my name, lady. I intend no intrusion, but I've no desire to see the beastmen any closer than I must. Their leavings are sight enough. Burned farms and slaughtered livestock all the way from Grand Gorge. Only by luck have I made it so far without meeting them. I expect I would make a fair account of myself if forced, but better to avoid trouble.
Talina nodded, then turned to the hunched-over creature that Bretron still held at sword point.
And you?
I?
The creature drew itself up to its full height, which was still just barely taller than Bretron's chest.
Am being called Grath. And this?
His hairy arms rose into a sweeping gesture, indicating the group that had crowded into his shelter.
Is most rudeness.
His voice was gruff, but not extraordinarily low, and it seemed too high for his bulk, especially after Olgoth's rumble. Grath eyed Bretron up the length of the sword, whose tip still hung a finger's width from his neck, and declaimed,
"Bargering in, pointing nasty sharp sword at Grath, deepest shamefulness."
Bretron snorted and raised the point of his sword a little more toward the ugly creature's chin.
Oh, and it's out of a peace-loving nature you were holding that when I found you? I don't fancy a troll love tap.
He pointed his chin at a huge, gnarled hunk of wood that looked to be a club of some sort, a few links away on the floor. Grath brought his hands up in a half-shrug of protest.
Must have protection. Half-men want to eat Grath. Been trying for days and days.
Talina raised a hand and said to Bretron,
"Peace, son of Degran. There is no harm for us in this one, I think. Troll he may be, but he's hardly a beast. Less still a wereman. And besides...
She trailed off with a slight twitch of her shoulders. Bretron's lips flattened in a half-irritated, half-ironic line, and he lowered the sword until the point rested against his boot. For a moment he seemed about to speak, then his taciturn nature reasserted itself, and he subsided. Grath sniffed at Bretron, then began straightening and patting at the loose robe he wore. 5. Talina looked around and nodded.
Shall we move deeper? We dare not attract the wrong sort of attention by lingering here.
She started to take a step forward, but Cirith planted her hands on her hips and said challengingly,
You mean we're just letting them come with us?
Talina frowned at her, obviously irritated, and asked,
You remember the prophecy, girl? The Princess of the Woodlands, the Scion of Watchmen Bright, the Child of Dwarves and Fairies, the Giant from the East, the Son of Fallen Simia?
Talina nodded to each of their party as she recited. Cirith frowned and motioned to her companion.
And what of Malachi? I hear nothing of him in those prophecies.
Talina flicked her head from side to side.
You ask for answers I do not possess. I'm neither scholar nor seer.
Cirith sniffed loudly.
In that case, how did you find this cave, and how did he follow us?
She indicated Olgoth, who stood impassively behind them.
If the were things can't.
Cirith gave an involuntary glance toward the entrance to their cave. Talina's mouth curved into a half-amused expression.
As to that, elf magic is strong with the trees and living things. Confusing our sense was a bit difficult, but it should lead them a merry chase, and...
She frowned.
This place has a peculiar feel to it. It called to me. Even had I not been able to find it by other means, its presence would have impressed itself on me.
Talina shook her head and pointed deeper into the cave.
And now we had best move on. If you two will accompany us, we can talk more, wherever this leads.
She cocked an eyebrow at Grath.
Have you explored the cave to any depth? We'd best get inward and away from the weremen. There is still a smell of us coming from this place.
Grath's face contorted into a grimace.
Goes deep, deep. Smell magic.
He shrugged.
No like magic.
Then his face contorted more, and he bared his teeth.
No like magic. Hate half-men. I come.
Talina nodded, and seemed about to speak, but Olgoth cleared his throat and shook his head.
Pardon me, lady. I know nothing of prophecies, but even so, I too may accompany you. I've no love for the weremen you called them.
The giant's voice rumbled from deep in his chest, and he fixed his eyes on Talina.
I will ask, however, to whom do you give your allegiance? Mine belongs to the King of Yore. I keep no company with his enemies.
There was silence for a moment, then Bretron grunted and said dryly,
Allegiance is a touchy question on this side of the ocean, giant.
Bretron's observation was, if anything, an understatement. The great oath magically bound those who spoke it to follow the one to whom they pledged. In the previous age, the oath had been given only to great powers, such as the King of Yore, or his enemy, the Nameless One. In the modern day, it was a much chancier business, and knowing another's allegiance could give one power over them, binding as the oath was. Olgoth stared at him, levelly, immovable, and suddenly incredibly dangerous.
Allegiance is a touchy question, the world over, Dagani. Yet these are extraordinary circumstances. I walk not with enemies of the king.
Then he frowned.
Your people are said to serve, Dagani. You should hardly fear to answer, unless it is not so.
Grath shrugged his massive shoulders.
Grath serves king, not afraid.
He shuffled his feet awkwardly. then looked challengingly at the rest of the party, daring any of them to criticize his bold declaration. Bretron, too, shrugged.
My people serve more in word than deed. But I've not to lose by answering. My sword is the king's.
Cirith sniffed.
There is no master worthy of allegiance among the folk. The Fae serve others with many words, and only themselves in truth. The oath is held quiet among us. For me, I serve the king.
Malachi smiled a half-amused, half-ironic smile, and nodded agreement. Talina raised an eyebrow, then gave an ironic half-smile herself.
My people hold to the old ways. I, too, serve the king.
Olgoth shook his head sadly.
Among the giants, there are few who claim the king as master in this age, and fewer still who serve with their hearts as well as their tongues, much less swear to his service. Yet of those, I am one. My path then lies with you.
He glanced down the tunnel.
And we are all king's men. We've naught to fear.
Talina frowned.
Come then.
She stepped forward, leading her mare deeper into the mountain. The children followed, walking side by side, leading their horse. Leading his stallion, Bretron made a point of following Grath to keep an eye on him. Olgoth brought up the rear. As they continued, the cave grew dimmer and dimmer, but in the little light they had, the party could see that the walls had opened out somewhat more, and Olgoth no longer had to stoop to avoid the ceiling. There was a decidedly musty smell to the air, and the floor and walls were smooth and grew more perfectly so with every step. After a minute or two, Talina half turned and said,
I think it is no accident we found this place, and this tunnel was not made by natural means.
Soon the darkness around them was complete. Talina walked more and more slowly until the group was just inching along, feeling their way forward like worms in the darkness. They continued that way for what seemed like hours, the rustle of their movement loud in their ears, their footfalls echoing from the polished walls. Grath was grumbling quietly, monotonously, his epithets punctuated by the thump, thump, thump of Olgoth's staff, when a light appeared in the middle of the group, half blinding them all. Bretron's sword came out and Talina whipped around, but the light dimmed to a bearable level, so they could see a tiny ball of blue flame hovering over Cirith's hand. She looked at their startled expressions and blinked in surprise.
Sorry, there's a ley line down there.
She pointed at the floor.
I just felt it. It must be coming to the surface.
Bretron sheathed his sword, uttering a soft oath as Talina nodded, and Olgoth rumbled,
Or mayhap we go down to meet it. Seems rather a large one. For one so young, you've skill if you're able to tap that.
Grath made a harsh sound of disgust, and they resumed their slow, trudging walk downward into the bowels of the mountain. With Cirith's light as a guide, they proceeded at a more reasonable rate, but whether they traveled for an hour or a day, none of them could afterward have said. It was a long time, certainly, and they all fell into a semi-stupor, pressing ahead step by step through the darkness. Talina wondered as she walked why time was so strange. It might have been a week since the night began, yet she had no doubt it was barely midnight. They walked for what might have been an age, and time crawled past at a trickle. She wondered, but had no answer. Slowly, as they moved deeper into the mountain, the stone turned from the gray it had been near the entrance to a deep, light-consuming black that seemed to drain away the tiny ball still flickering over Cirith's outstretched hand. It was some time before Talina noticed, and the nagging doubts she had felt since entering the cave flared up inside her. Something about what lay ahead seemed wrong, just as had the wind in the clearing. Something beyond sensing, but there all the same. There was something about the earth itself that was evil in a way she couldn't quite define. Still, she kept on. There was no going back. Not with weremen outside. The trek was a long one, and their minds, already weary from the long chase, were lulled into a stupor by the monotony of putting one foot in front of another, and the darkness of the deep earth. Time took on an ephemeral quality, elastic and not easy to recognize. Reality became a repetition of step, 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 one after another, until their minds were numbed and dull. It was barely noticeable at first, something that nagged at minds befuddled by the darkness, but didn't quite bring itself to their notice. Slowly, imperceptibly, the light in the tunnel had been increasing. After a time, it easily outshone Cirith's little flame. The walls were still the same unblemished black stone, but light seeped through it to fill the tunnel with a strange radiance. The process was so gradual that Talina didn't even notice until she stepped directly out into the full glare of a blazing white light. It was like being thrust suddenly onto a stage before an audience of thousands. Talina felt more exposed than she ever had in her life. She stopped stock still and slowly backed up until she was again hidden in the shadows. The sudden stop had alerted the others, and Malachi and Cirith crowded up beside Talina, with Bretron and Grath on her other side, now staring ahead out of the passage. Olgoth's height allowed him to watch over the rest of the party's heads. Talina followed their gaze, and what she saw caught her eye and held it. 6. Ahead, well over 100 links ahead, was a pool of light that reflected itself off the smooth midnight black stone. The light was dim at the edges, so there was no obvious line where the light stopped and the darkness began. At the center, however, the circle of stone was as well lit as a summer's day. What was really odd about the sight was that the stone was still entirely black, and the light seemed to reflect from it only by virtue of their total incompatibility. Cirith stirred and yawned, then stopped still at the sight. Slowly, Talina led them forward and out into the light, looking warily around. The light, they saw as they filed hesitantly out of the passage, came from a brilliant point that hung in midair, far, far above them. They slowly walked toward the pool of brilliance, leading the horses and gazing up at the light's source. Strangely, the light did not blind them, but neither could they see what actually caused it. The glow was fierce but cold, and they stared at it, mesmerized. The group stopped as if by one accord, and they approached the place where the light began to reflect from the stone at their feet. For long moments, they simply stood, their eyes fixed on the brilliance above them.
Beautiful, isn't it?
They all looked down from their reverie to see Malachi seated cross-legged on the floor, just where the light began to brighten. All of them, even Talina, blinked at him in incomprehension, and he smiled whimsically, almost ironically.
The light has shone on this floor for nearly 2,000 turnings.
He shook his head, eyes distant.
Back then, it was so bright, it lit the cavern like daylight. On winter night, the mountains glowed with it. The power is fading, the binding growing weaker.
Malachi broke off for a moment. Then, in the still stupefied silence, he asked,
"Would you like to see?"
Cirith nodded, awe painted across her face.
"Please?"
Malachi smiled and said,
"A moment then, little sister."
He got to his feet and turned away from them to gaze upward. After a moment, in total silence, the light began to descend. By this time, the group's consternation had turned to questions. Every single one of the party was near to bursting with them. Still, none broke the silence, and Malachi continued to stare up at the growing light for a long time, as it slowly descended until it hovered barely twice Olgoth's height above them, shining ever more brightly in the darkness. They could see now that the light emanated from a crystal the size of two fists, held together and filled with blue-white radiance.
"You are fortunate,"
Malachi said, slowly turning back to them.
"But perhaps not as most would measure it."
He looked bemused for a moment, as if having some inner conversation none of them could hear. Then he shook his head.
"Do you know why you are here?"
He looked at each of them in turn, a long, hard look as if searching for something. Then he turned and began to pace slowly back and forth. None of them answered. The sheer presence Malachi exerted made it obvious that he wasn't simply a little boy.
You are here to fulfill your oath. Master Olgoth came closer than he knew when he asked our allegiance.
Malachi paused, smiling a bit ironically.
Each of you swore fealty to one this world has all but forgotten.
His eyes swept over them again.
Many pay him lip service, but few remember there is a living man behind the name. Or if they do, they do not believe he will ever return to claim his due. Even you, who have bound yourselves to him with the great oath, only know him as an idea. He is at best a distant reality to you, an absent ideal. Few indeed have bound themselves to him with the oath. To most of the world, the king of yore is nothing more than an old story. The Shi are a mere ghost of a memory, a legend perhaps. Even you, though you believe enough to pledge him your life, know very little of his reality, or of what that oath meant. The world is about to change, my friends. I would say that your faithfulness is to be rewarded, but in the short term, that reward will be trials more severe than you can imagine. But the battle that comes upon us is the most important in the history of Eschaton. The final battle is beginning, and the faithful of the king must be prepared for it. That is why you have been gathered here this winter night.
Malachi turned fully toward them and said with a ghost of a smile,
Our time is limited. I'm sure you have questions. I will answer as I may, but I have no time or patience for foolishness.
Talina's was the first voice to break the silence.
Who are you, boy? Or what are you, really?
Malachi's mouth quirked.
I told you, my name is Malachi. As to what? Well, there is a more interesting question.
He considered a moment.
I have been many things, a traveler, a warrior, a diplomat, and a prince. Of late, I have been a brother to one in need. To you, I am a messenger, but first and always, I am a liegeman of the king.
With that, he bowed his head for a moment, then stared straight at Talina. Gaze intense, he asked.
And what are you, lady? You are a princess among your people, but you have run away from your responsibilities to chase a fancy.
Talina looked aghast.
I have sought to fulfill the prophecies of yore.
Malachi shook his head.
Honesty will serve you better.
Talina shrank back and seemed about to bolt.
Grandfather, Incalith himself, said I would never be an elder. What do you ask of me?
Malachi's voice was gentle.
You are asked only to fulfill the promise you made to his majesty so many turnings ago. Do you remember?
Talina nodded timidly, her usual self-assurance reduced to confusion. Malachi looked at each of them in turn.
Do not mistake me. You were called here, each in your own way. You have done well to come.
He fell silent for a moment, and Bretran pointed at the crystal.
To be in command of such a wonder, you must be a great wizard. Why did you not save us, even the one you claim as sister, from the Weirmen?
Malachi shook his head.
I am no wizard, or not as you might think of such things,
he said thoughtfully.
And even had I the power to do as you say, what gain would we have from it? The first lesson a great wizard must learn is that greatness is found far more in using well what you have been given than in the magnitude of your power. The smallest pebble can dam the mightiest river if it falls into place properly.
He shook his head again, emphatically.
No. Had I interfered, it would have called worse onto our heads than a few changers.
Then Malachi cocked his head.
But what of your friends, and those you call your people? True, you are no wizard, but you have influence enough. Haven't you the power to save the freeholders if you choose?
Bretran shrugged.
I am no king. The council decides. If I usurp them now, I will inherit nothing.
Malachi sneered.
You put your own pride before your subjects' lives. What sort of king would you be?
Bretron countered, his face stormy.
In war, a commander must not lose his command for fear of casualties. Nor am I responsible for the freeholders. They're not sworn to the crown.
Malachi's face fell.
So says one reclaimed at great cost from the greatest enemy of all. And what of the sword? How many must pay for your pride?
Bretron paled and bowed his head, and Malachi turned to Cirith with a smile.
I see you waiting, little sister. What say?
Cirith's eyes widened.
This means you're leaving.
She stared at him hard, trying not to cry.
Doesn't it?
Her eyes started to tear up.
Don't you care for me?
Malachi's smile was bittersweet.
Dear little sister, you knew it must happen someday. Will you wound me for a departure whose time has come?
Cirith hung her head as silent tears began to drip from her face.
Sorry,
Malachi's smile turned gentle.
Yes, dear one, I love you too. Remember what was promised. Eyes clear.
She nodded, head still bowed, then asked,
You've told me much of the king, but what is he? Is he a man? One of the gods?
Malachi's twisted smile reappeared.
What is a man? Is a man a she? A Gigan? One of the Fae, perhaps? And what of the gods? Are the dragons gods? The youngest dragon spawned before the first she walked the face of Eschaton. Yet even they die when their purpose ends. What of the Engils? A great Engil could stir the cauldron like a bowl of soup, yet they are feared as demons if men know of them at all. And there are men who worship rocks. What makes a god? As to the king, he is as much a man as you or I. Or perhaps...
Malachi's mouth quirked.
Better to say that we are as human as he is. There has never been a man to equal him, nor has any other man walking the face of Eschaton lived since before the betrayal. Your question has no easy answer. He is what he is.
Cirith nodded thoughtfully, and Malachi smiled at her.
I daren't carry on too long, little sister. We have yet to complete our purpose here.
He raised an eyebrow at Olgoth.
What of you?
Olgoth shuffled his feet and cleared his throat uneasily, the unself-conscious stolidity he had shown so far now absent.
What question dare I ask, young master, when I know that I too have much to be ashamed of?
Malachi looked at the giant speculatively.
So cleverness leads you to refuse? Or is it pride that seeks to hide your shortcomings? Fear, perhaps?
Olgoth looked thoughtful, then shook his head ruefully.
Say what you will, then, young master. I stand at your pleasure. You need not await any question of mine to make your condemnation.
Malachi shook his head.
Do not misunderstand. I do not speak to condemn you. The path ahead is steep. You cannot afford pride or fear. They will undo you.
Malachi turned to Grath and nodded.
And you?
Grath brought one ham-sized hand up to his chin and squeezed thoughtfully.
Why Grath here?
Malachi raised his eyebrows.
You're asking me why you came?
Grath shook his head vehemently.
No, no, no. Grath told to come. Grath come. What do now?
Malachi smiled.
Listen, watch, learn, make new friends, then go home and take care of your family. They will need you in the time to come.
Grath nodded, satisfied, and Malachi's gaze swept across the rest of the little party as if seeking something. He waited a moment, then nodded and bowed his head. 7. There was silence as Malachi began pacing back and forth through the edge of the light. The little party of travelers simply stood, watching. Suddenly, Malachi stopped and looked at them, and behind him something began to take shape in the light coming down from the crystal. Patterns of light coalesced in midair, colors seeping from white lines to form a great landscape in the air before them. Then, as they watched, the landscape morphed and changed. Once, twice, three times, then again and again, faster and faster, finally blurring out into a field of shifting luminescence.
"This is our world,"
Malachi said, as the scene finally came to rest, a perfect representation of the Black Mountains under which they stood.
"The world is a brutal place."
As Malachi spoke, the scene changed to a huge beast tearing at something on the ground. Its head came up, and a man's foot could be seen protruding from its mouth. Cirith gasped in horror and turned her face away as the beast gulped down the leg, then rapidly morphed and changed, leaving what might have been a man in its place, if it wasn't twisted and misshapen.
"The seven races are at each other's throats. Life, even the life of men, is worth little. There have been generations of war between the Changers and the Degani. Their hatred for one another is implacable. No quarter is given to civilians on either side, even women or children. Open war may yet be avoided among many of the races, but conflict is everywhere. Mistrust and treachery are more the rule than the exception. The Thurgans hold the Simeonites in their thrall, but for a few scattered tribes, the entire race of Simia is enslaved by its more magical brothers. Nor is slaving practiced only by the Thurgians. The Changers and the Fae often keep their brothers in bondage, and there are those who hold slaves among all the races."
The scene changed again, this time to a group of men as grotesque as the first, gathered beneath a great rock upon which another man, tattooed all over and holding bones in either hand, stood shaking his fists above his head. Then he raised his face and hands to the sky in supplication. At his feet another knelt, obviously of the same race as he, but bound, with his head bowed. The tattooed one replaced the bones on his belt and brought out a knife, then raised it above his head and plunged it into his victim. Once, twice, a third time. The bound form before him slumped as the tattooed figure again raised his hands to the sky, howling in triumph. Malachi's voice was raw with anger, and his eyes flashed.
"This one claims to be a direct representative of his majesty, yet he treats his own people as slaves. Those who disobey are executed as blood sacrifices. Their life force is siphoned off to feed the shaman's magic. Abuse of the king's authority is as vile as it is widespread."
The scene changed to show a group of giants gathered in a circle around a stone altar. One giant held a deer, its legs bound together, head tucked safely under one of his great arms. Another giant held a huge knife, with which he gently, almost tenderly, cut into the deer's neck. Malachi shook his head.
"Blood sacrifice, too, is everywhere, though the people cloak it in pretty euphemisms and petty excuses."
The light behind Malachi shifted to a bright haze, and he said, his voice heavy,
"It has not always been so. Once the world was a brighter place, before the Cataclysm and the Great War. Then the world was home to the Shi, the men of old. They were bound to the world by their magic, and all the creatures of the earth were their subjects. In those days, the king himself walked Eschaton. It was long ago, and much of what we remember is half-truths and tales grown large in the retelling. It was in the Cataclysm that the world of today was born, out of fire and chaos and destruction. When the land and its magic were sundered, so were the people of the land, and the seven races of man are all that remain of the great Shi."
Malachi trailed off with a frown, and considered for a moment before continuing.
"There are many tales of the Cataclysm. Some believe it was the work of the Nameless One and his followers, that he sundered the world out of spite and hatred, jealous of the king's favor. And the king left in sorrow for the land from which he had came in time beyond memory. Others hold that the Cataclysm was the result of a great war, that the king and the Nameless One rent the world with their battle,
that the Nameless One was destroyed, and the king was driven away by the terrible magics they released. Some say that the king himself was responsible, that he was displeased with the Shi and their pride, and set the Nameless One upon them, to tear the world asunder and enslave all who survived. There are many more tales, vile ones, foolish ones, and some very, very dangerous ones.
Malachi shrugged and began to pace again.
It is not my affair which of these tales you believe. If your heart would know the truth, then in time you will find it.
His lips twisted into a wry grin.
Very little of it bears on what I must tell you. You need only know that your forefathers left you a legacy of chains that remains to this day. Just as the Shi were bound to the land, so they could bind themselves at will to whatever or whoever they chose. The old magic was stronger and more enduring than the very bedrock of this world. Bits remain, even today.
He paused for a moment and smiled wryly.
Among the Shi, allegiance was a matter of pride, not shame or fear as it is now. Ila Briela e Hoenye, the Great Oath, is one such remnant of old magic, though it has but a shadow of the power.
There was a hiss of indrawn breath from one or two of the little party, and Bretron snorted.
The oath is unbreakable. What can be more powerful?
Malachi's smile went crooked.
Not unbreakable. Infernally difficult to break. Powerful and dangerous, but not unbreakable. The old magic was, well, a step beyond even unbreakable. For it is the old magic itself that holds the world together. It is old magic that makes the sun rise and fall, and old magic that holds the moon in its place. It is impossible even to imagine breaking the old magic, for it defines existence.
It was as if Bretron's question had broken a barrier of some sort, and Cirith piped up.
What do you mean?
Malachi stopped pacing, and his face was deadly serious.
I mean that you are still bound by the greatest oath ever sworn, an oath your ancestors swore to the Nameless One itself. You are not bound as they were. Even the old magic wanes with the generations, but bound more closely than if you spoke the great oath to the Nameless One right now, even if not as tightly.
You speak in riddles, young master.
Olgoth shook his head.
I hear your words without understanding. You speak wonders, but what do they mean?
Malachi shrugged.
Simply that much of the world still serves the Nameless One, whatever they may think or will.
Bretron snorted again.
I don't believe in fate.
Malachi looked at him with an irritated frown.
Nor I, but this is not fate. It is no less true. Allegiance is held both sacred and secret today. And for a good reason. What happens when a liege man tries to break the great oath?
Bretron blinked.
He cannot. His own mind will rebel unto death. He is compelled.
Malachi nodded.
Just so. But...
he gave a twisted smile.
Even bindings in the old magic can be broken, given time, and the king will remember his own, though the rest of the world may forget him. There are a few, like us, who have sworn themselves to the king, and for us, the fetters of abomination are broken.
Olgoth shook his great head, almost in disbelief.
To half the world, even among those who claim to believe, the king is a myth. Yet you speak as if you know him. 2/3 of the world has forgotten the Gananim, the Nameless, yet you say they are bound to his service. If it is so, how could so few know of it?
Malachi nodded at Olgoth's question, then looked around at the others.
Bear with me a little longer. It will become clear.
He resumed pacing, then continued.
As little as we remember of the cataclysm, we know what followed in terrible detail. Eschaton settled in an age of confusion and chaos. Then a time of peace, or so it seemed, the Nameless One built a kingdom that enslaved half of Eschaton, and would have enslaved the rest, but for the wizard.
The air behind Malachi, which had remained empty for a long time, again began to shimmer and take on form. When the light had gathered, it showed a forest, malformed and grotesque. The trees were alive, but would never be healthy, and there was no beauty left in them. Everything about the scene was warped, and the plants looked poisonous.
There was nothing that he did not twist to his purposes.
The scene changed to show a great black shape, like a bear, but bigger and bulkier. It was tearing at something unrecognizable and mutilated that struggled to escape, but could not.
The plants, the animals, the birds, everything became his tool. The men were the worst, by far.
Malachi shuddered and looked hard at each of them as the light behind him rippled, then finally disappeared like smoke.
I will not show you what he can do to a human if we choose to allow it. You will learn soon enough.
Malachi subsided again, and he looked thoughtful.
Now, as to the wizard. Some say he was one of the Shi, come back to fight for the world he loved. Some say it was the king himself, returned to do battle with his ancient foe. Some say it was the king's son, or his servant, or another of his people. Some believe there was no wizard, that one of the great princes of Dagon joined the giants to do battle with the Nameless One. Most say the wizard went to battle with the Nameless One and destroyed it, then returned from this world to the one from where he came. The little we know of him comes from the Book of Yore, the prophecies he left behind. Many have puzzled over the book and found little of use. Today, men say there was no wizard, or even that there was no Nameless One. After the Great War, they disappeared. It had been thousands of turnings since the Battle of Ages. Most have forgotten. It is easy to doubt, with the wizard gone and the Nameless One with him. Most would rather doubt than know, for it allows them to do as they will. Their lives are easier when they forget. The Nameless One has become a story to scare the children. Only a few will remember it all, and they are more often the Nameless One's own followers. Time turns, and the world moves on. All is forgotten.
Malachi nodded to Olgoth.
There is your explanation, big brother, though there is more, even than that.
The light behind Malachi rippled yet again, and he said, half to himself,
so much forgotten, so much lost.
Eight. Then, turning his attention fully back to them, he smiled at Bretron.
You called me a wizard. What you call magic is, well, first it is energy, power that can be manipulated by those with the gift and the knowledge. Raw energy can be turned to many purposes, more easily destruction than life. The Nameless One was not always a creature of flesh and blood. First it was an Engil, a being made holy of magic. The Engils are creatures unlike us. They do not even live in our world. We do not know where they come from or how they were made. But the Nameless One was not content to be as it was. By a great working, one more powerful than any other ever attempted, it was made flesh and became the greatest enemy to this world that has ever been. You see, by the king's decree, only men can rule this world, and control is what the Nameless craves.
Malachi paused, and his lip curled in something between disgust and bitterness.
The Watchmen call him Nameless. You?
Malachi looked at Talina.
You call him Bizam Yani.
He turned his gaze to Olgoth.
You say Gan Anim. To the Fae, he is a Nathnid. To the Simeonites, Degayaso. The Thurgans know him as Niv-Telen, the Changers as Inami. All mean the same. To this world, he is the Nameless One. None call him by his rightful name, for fear that they may call his attention down upon them. For his followers, it is a token of respect.
Malachi frowned.
Many are right to fear. We who are sworn to the king need not. His rightful name is Sheklaw, disturber of all. Sheklaw the Defiler. Sheklaw the Neverman.
There were sounds of distress from one or two of them, and Malachi smiled a bit ruefully before continuing.
The world from which Sheklaw came, the world of magic, is ethereal, ever-changing and shaped to the will of any creature that lives there or here. This world is dust and stone, unyielding and solid. Sheklaw's will is to change the world to fit its own perverse whim. The weak are its slaves, and the strong are its enemies. It sees no other way.
Malachi paused to look at each of them seriously.
And it is coming back.
Again, Malachi stared hard at each of them.
So you learn what your service is to be. The end of the age approaches. I tell you now, Sheklaw was not destroyed. It was only defeated.
And locked away here.
Cirith interrupted excitedly. The other members of the party stared at her, as if she'd interrupted some sort of solemn religious ceremony. Perhaps in a way she had, but Malachi only smiled at her quizzically.
Locked away? Why do you say so, little sister?
Because that's the rhyme. Locked away, an age to stay, asleep and entombed in the Blackland's womb.
Cirith proclaimed. Malachi opened his mouth as if to speak, then visibly rethought what he'd been about to say. He shrugged.
As you say, his power was broken and bound, sealed away from the world.
He stared at the floor beneath their feet.
Of Sheklaw itself, only the wizard knows. But his seal weakens a bit more every day, sapped and eaten away by the darkness of this place.
He pointed to the great crystal shining down upon them.
And Sheklaw knows, such is its nature, to yearn and hate and strain for the destruction of any who might not submit to its tortured will. There are still those who follow it, a few by consent and consciously, and many by pride and fear and hate, tied to it by an ancient promise that may not be broken. It is to Sheklaw's advantage that the people do not believe, so that when it comes once more into its full power, the world is unprepared for it and unbelieving.
He smiled a wry, twisted smile.
The ones who scoff loudest are often his own followers, for the first and most potent of the enemy's weapons is a lie, and that,
Malachi paused and looked at each of them meaningfully,
is how you will know him and his ilk. Where truth is, hope is.
Talina looked thoughtfully at Malachi and said,
it has been many an age since the Byzamyanis.
She stopped and looked at Malachi with an eyebrow raised.
Since Sheklaw's defeat. But the elves still remember. The world was a terrible place, ravaged and torn. It is said that the very rocks cried out in agony at the corruption.
Her eyes were far away, as if remembering something. Then she cocked her head slightly.
What would you have us do?
Malachi nodded to her, appreciative.
Return home, lady. Return home and prepare. There were to be 7 of you. I see 5.
His eyes glinted, and he searched each face carefully.
5 of you to carry the most important news the world has ever heard. 5 of you to prepare the way. The wizard, too, will return when the time is right. And that is what you must tell them.
Then, in an instant, Malachi's eyes turned hard as steel and bright as the noonday sun, and his voice rang through the cavern, sending back echoes from walls impossibly distant.
There is no middle ground. Tell them that the time of the reckoning is coming.
Malachi bowed his head, and when he looked up again, his voice was calm and gentle.
I have told you that we stand upon the tomb of the greatest evil in the history of Eschaton. Have you not wondered that none of Sheklaw's allies wait here to guard it?
He looked at Bretran.
You asked why I did not intervene. This place is one of the most dangerous in the world. It is guarded, on one hand, by the greatest talisman of the greatest wizard the world has ever known, by traps, magical and mechanical.
By a maze of tunnels and passageways that honeycombs the entire mountain range, and by secrets even I do not know. On the other hand, are the closest and most powerful allies of the evil incarnate, as well as the lowest rabble of the underworld, attracted by the pull of his magic. This is all that keeps them at bay, the worst of them.
Malachi pointed up at the light above their heads.
Look.
Malachi pointed outward, away from the light, and as their eyes followed his hand, the great crystal flashed, its light so bright it should have blinded them. Standing on three sides of their little pool of light, just out of reach in what had been the darkness, were creatures from a nightmare. All three were the same, with a shape to haunt the darkest of dreams. The flash of blue-white light seemed to absorb into flesh as black as the walls themselves, the darkness of their forms spreading into great wings that reached out and out and out from them to fill the air above the little party. The creature's shape was surprisingly well-defined, even in the dimness, but it was the dull blood-red eyes that brought true horror. Whatever they had once been, pure torment had shaped their current form, and the distilled evil they embodied pulled at the little party's minds. They seemed to reach into the very soul and bring out the darkest fears and hatreds to feed upon them. Then the light had faded. They all stood there in shock, Malachi simply frowning. The rest huddled closer to the center of their circle of light. Light that they now realized was life itself to the little party.
Dark angels?
Cirith's voice was hardly above a whisper, and her eyes were as wide as twin moons. Malachi smiled sadly.
Angels once, perhaps. Not now. Angels are free creatures, temperamental, but not evil. These are demons, angels bound to Shekla's will and forced to serve him against their own purpose. Shekla's first aim is to break the spirit, and the angels are spirit in its truest form, magic. These have been broken and remade so many times that they are now mere reflections of their master's will.
He smiled humorlessly.
Gargoyles are worse, and there are others, but most have not been seen since the Great War. They chose Shekla of their own free will. Those that remain hide now, awaiting its return.
How did we not meet these before?
Bretron's mouth quirked.
I'm not ungrateful. I'd fight a whole tribe of weremen before one of them.
Malachi just shrugged.
It is winter night. Time, distance, even reality itself runs strangely here, especially on winter night. And...
his mouth quirked.
You had special protection. You came unknowing, bearing no thought of Shekla, and you all bear the mark of the king. But that does not guarantee your way out, or even your passage beyond our three... hosts. Steel is no impediment to such as them. That much, however, I may be able to help you with. After that, well, your best option is speed.
It's a node, isn't it?
Cirith asked, cutting Malachi off. He blinked in confused surprise, then chuckled.
Yes, there is a ley node not far away, and that tunnel follows a major ley line.
Cirith frowned.
Major ley lines are so big. That little bit of fire was hard. I don't know how much I can draw without losing control.
Malachi nodded.
That ley line was one of the reasons we got in so easily. Even creatures sensitive to magic find it difficult to see those who walk so close to the big ley lines. No fear, little sister. You need not risk it. I can do you one last service.
Abruptly, he turned to Bretron.
Take care of her, watchman.
He motioned to Cirith, then turned and pointed back the way they came.
It is time for you to go.
9. Cirith opened her mouth to argue, but Malachi said,
"The night is waning. Soon the light from the crystal will fade. You do not want to be here then."
Talina nodded abruptly and motioned to the others, and suddenly they were moving. Talina had swung up on her mare, and Bretron pulled Cirith up in front of him. Bretron held the lead rein for the third horse, which Graf had somehow clambered onto. The beast didn't look too happy, but as Bretron and Talina turned to go, it bolted after the other two, directly for the cave where they had entered. Before they were clear of the circle of light, the great crystal flared, and white light shone on the midnight black cavern wall around the entrance, reflecting from it in the same eerie way as on the floor earlier. Now, however, the radiance was mixed with a painful red light that seemed to sear into the rock. As they passed from sight, something compelled each of them to glance back. Malachi still stood directly under the crystal, while facing him from three directions, the daemons stood upon the jet-black rock of the cave floor. Voice strong and clear, Malachi called,
"Be gone from this place. Your time is not yet come. A prison awaits you. Go."
The sight lasted for a seemingly interminable moment. Then they were inside the cave, bending low over their horses' necks, dodging blindly around corners none of the riders could see. The horses seemed to know their way, however, and there was something about the cavern they had just left that urged both horses and riders onward, not allowing them to think of what might lie ahead. It was the nameless terror of something impossible yet real, come to life in some horrible insanity. Only Cirith tore free for long enough to cry,
"Malachi! Malachi!"
They were dodging through the passageway only a few moments away from the cavern, when light pierced through the darkness of the mountain, washing away the black of the stone and turning the rock a glowing, pulsing white. It lasted for a mere moment before the black stone absorbed the light as if it had never been. Then the sound hit, a roar of rage and combat and destruction, like some terrible force of nature, frustrated in the act of tearing its enemy to pieces. The sound passed as quickly as the light, and silence reigned once more. The silence was somehow even more terrible, though, and the horses raced on, hooves noiseless against the black stone. They ran for a long time, the horse's breath heavy in the enclosed space, the terror never fading even with the time it took to run the length of the cave. It was a time immeasurable in the darkness before they broke out, seemingly all at once into the same night they had left behind. How long had it been? The same night? It seemed impossible. They reined up, and Bretron stared back into the cave, as Olgoth crawled out of it on hands and knees, nearly scraping his back on the low arch at the exit. Talina, however, moved farther out from the cliff, glancing around uneasily. Their exit from the cave had brought them back to their senses, and the terror of their long run was fading. As her senses cleared, however, Talina's uneasiness shifted in another direction. There was something wrong. None of them saw the figures step out of the surrounding woods. It was as if they were a part of the forest itself, until one spoke. Then somehow they were all just there, as if they'd been there the entire time.
"Ah, you have returned. The Dark Lord said you would, but I scarcely believed."
The voice had a hissing, rasping quality, and Talina started violently, wheeling her horse to face the speaker, who laughed loudly in amusement.
"You didn't think I saw you when you did your little disappearing trick? We know better than to go into that place."
He eyed the cave balefully.
"You are one of the changers. What pact do you claim?"
The creature's eyes flashed.
"You have no right to use that name."
Then he smiled.
"And I serve the Dark Lord, none other."
The wereman sounded lazy, like a cat toying with its food.
"However, when the aims of the pack match the aims of the Dark Lord, I will not complain."
The weremen had left a slight gap on the cliff side of their formation when they had stepped from the trees, and Talina found herself edging toward it along with the others as their enemies slowly closed in. There were at least a dozen of them, probably 15. As they drew nearer, Talina eyed the cliff at her back. More fun to corner your prey before you kill it, she thought grimly. Maybe even push it off a cliff, which is what was going to happen if they kept advancing. The wehrman seemed amused.
You did lead us a merry chase, you know.
Suddenly, Bretron lunged at one side of the formation, pulling back on his reins, his horse rearing, hooves flailing. At the same time, he pulled out his sword and swung it around, catching one of the wehrmen across the head. His stallion had picked its own target, and a forehoof came crashing down on another of the creatures. It screamed and fell backward to lie writhing in the snow, clutching its face as yellow blood streamed between its fingers. The exposed parts of its body immediately began to change, twisting and growing, until it was more beast than man. On the other side of Bretron, the same thing was happening to the other creature. Seeing the gap Bretron had made, Talina spoke to her horse, which plunged through to the other side of the enemy line. Meanwhile, Grath had taken a flying leap from the pack horse to land on another of the weremen and twist its head around in a full circle with his unbelievable simianite strength. He immediately proceeded to leap on yet another and wrestle it toward the ground. As Talina watched, Grath took hold of one of his enemy's shoulders and wrenched its arm impossibly far backward. It howled in anguish and disbelief as the limb dropped useless to its side. Olgoth was keeping a full five of the creatures busy with his huge staff, striking at one, then blocking another. They simply didn't have the reach to attack him effectively without falling to his staff. That left too many, however, and they were rushing forward. Bretron spurred his horse, trying to pull through, but at precisely the wrong moment, a changer jumped on the pack horse and it reared, screaming, into the air. Bretron was still holding its lead, and he was pulled from his saddle, his horse bolting forward with Cirith somehow still on its back. Bretron quickly regained his feet, but there were simply too many of the enemy. The only way to live was to give ground. A creature on the left struck out just too far, overbalancing itself, and Bretron too struck, ducking the creature's blow and impaling it on his sword. The combination of its imbalance and weight were too much, however, driving Bretron off the edge of the cliff. He toppled backward, the beast falling with him. Grath and Olgoth, too, were on the very precipice. Talina cried out, but there was no time to stop. Three of the weremen were already turning toward her and Cirith, who still sat on Bretron's stallion, leaving five surrounding Grath and Olgoth. Even as she watched, however, one of the five dodged just a bit too slowly, and Olgoth's staff cracked it across the head as he swept it around to block one of the others. The three weremen began to run toward them, and Talina whispered again to her mare, which set off running into the darkness, Cirith and the stallion right behind. As they raced away, Talina thought grimly of Malachi. She still wasn't quite certain what to think of the boy and what he had said, but she could not doubt the truth behind his words. He was almost certainly still alive, but soon the Nameless One would be loose as well. She thought also of the prophecies. They had been missing two of their number, or possibly only one. What of that? She shook her head. There was no way to know. The Nameless One would require months, perhaps turnings, to build his power, to break free again. Malachi had not said how long they might have. There was time to raise an army, and, maybe, to defeat the Nameless One. She thought of Bretron in the cliff, but she had Cirith to look out for. The others would simply have to take care of themselves. Yes, there was time, but time made all the more precious by the gravity of the situation. Epilogue. The old man paused for a long moment, as if reflecting, then seemingly returned to the present, said,
"And so, as you see, a strange tale indeed, and one that I sometimes doubt the truth of."
There was a quiet gasp from the corner of the room, and all three strangers' heads snapped around toward the sound. They rose, and two of them circled outward, one moving into the middle of the room, the other passing him to stand near the wall. So the three surrounded the patron who had gasped. The inn had gone silent, and everyone huddled in their chairs, watching the three strangers with more than a little fear.
"You see,"
the leader said,
"we are searching for the two who escaped, for the story you told is true, old man. Doubt it though you may."
He slowly reached up and pulled back the hood on his cloak to expose a face twisted and deformed. Gleaming yellow eyes stared from sockets that seemed too small to hold them, while long ivory fangs, stained yellow in places, protruded from between his lips. Gasps went up around the room, and the inn's patrons cowered in their seats as the other two strangers followed their leader's example, revealing faces equally hideous. The two people at the table in the corner stood up and drew back against the wall, their hoods pulled low so their faces couldn't be seen. The three weremen reached inside their cloaks and drew swords. The beast's leader said,
"You, remove your hood so we may see who you are."
Slowly, the taller of the two figures removed his hood. As his face came into the light, they saw that it was a man so old, his wrinkles piled up under his proud, frightened eyes and around his face, like the weathered ridges and crags of a mountain. His beard was pure white. The smaller figure, seeing what the older had done, followed his example. It was a boy who looked to be about 10 turnings old, with a frightened yet somehow defiant look. A snarl with the undertones of a curse escaped the leader's lips, and the other two clamped their hands reflexively on their swords. He stared at the two for a long moment, then a low, evil chuckle escaped his lips, and he raised the hand not holding his sword. The sinister wolf man pointed two fingers at them, and a beam of yellow light flowed from his hand to touch each of their faces in turn. The mask of light covering their faces melted into nothing, leaving behind a young girl and a woman so beautiful her face seemed to shine. Her pointed ears and aristocratic features were out of place above plain gray robes. The girl was small, with short red hair and fine features. The change had been so complete that the only thing remaining of their former appearances was their eyes. The leader chuckled again.
"You've led us quite a merry chase, elf. Now is the time to finish what was started at the Black Lord's Mountain 2 moons ago."
Before the three could start forward, however, the sound of a sword being drawn came from the opposite corner of the room near the door. The weremen's heads turned, and suddenly Cirith's hand was moving, pulling something out of her sleeve and sending it flying through the air. A moment later, a knife buried itself in the throat of the creature next to the wall. As the dying beast clutched its throat, gurgling and trying to pull out the dagger, the leader turned to face the new danger, a man in a dirty brown cloak who moved quickly between tables toward the center of the room. The two remaining creatures started forward, one toward the girl and the elf, the other toward the man, both with swords raised. But the chair in which the leader had been sitting tipped over, and he tripped on it, twisting in the air, trying to land on his feet. He might have succeeded, except that the old man's tobacco-stained pipe skittered out of nowhere to land beneath his descending foot. As the foot came down on the pipe, it turned, and the beast man went off balance again, falling headfirst into the fire. Then came such an unearthly shriek as to make all the people in the room cover their ears in pain. It rang through the room as the creature writhed on the hearth, half his face blackened by fire and one yellow eye staring and sightless, embers sticking into the black mask that had been flesh. The other beastman's head snapped around to see what had happened to its leader, and the man in the brown cloak brought his sword around, cleaving its head from its shoulders. While it was still falling, the man turned toward the leader writhing on the hearth. Before he could start toward the creature, however, it rose with a howl of rage and pain and fled toward the door, sword still in hand. Instead of opening the door, though, the beast smashed it from its hinges and battered it to the ground outside the inn, and, still running, disappeared into the night. In the wake of the creature's panicked departure, Bretron walked over to the doorway and stared thoughtfully into the darkness for a moment. Shrugging, he picked up the door and pulled it back into the frame as squarely as possible. Then he turned back into the room and strode toward the corner, where Talina and Cirith stood. Cirith gave a cry and ran to him. He swept her up in a hug, then set her back on her feet and bowed slightly to Talina. She nodded, frowning, and said in her clear, musical voice,
"Why have you waited so long to show yourself? It has been nearly a month. More than once we found sign in the forest, but..."
He scowled in the direction of the door.
"When I fell down that cliff, I landed in a pile of snow. Atop the beast, thankfully. Soft snow, so I didn't break any bones, but the fall knocked me out. When I woke, I tried to dig myself out, but I couldn't. Grath and Ulgoth found me."
He grimaced again, embarrassed at the memory.
"By the time we found the trail, we were a day behind, without a horse. 2 weeks after we started on your trail, I found their tracks."
He jerked a thumb toward the dead beast man on the floor.
"We followed them."
He grimaced.
"I lost them yesterday, so I found you two before they could."
Talina nodded thoughtfully. Cirith was biting her lip, standing beside Talina's chair, and she said,
"I thought you were dead. Talina said she would know, but when you fell after Malachi..."
She trailed off, tears coming to her eyes, and Bretran smiled gently at her, the hard planes of his face softening.
"Couldn't leave you alone, could I?"
His lips curved into something half wry and half annoyed, and he broke his customary silence again to add,
"Malachi bid me to take care of you. He'd take it hard if I didn't, eh?"
She nodded, still sniffing. After a moment, Talina raised one eyebrow.
"What of the others?"
Bretran's mouth quirked, and he jerked a thumb to the south.
"Grath got chewed on. Ulgoth had to carry him. They're camped down there."
He grinned unexpectedly and then imitated Grath's voice.
"Big bag of wind, talk less, walk more. Grath crawl faster than big oaf walk."
The three sat down, leaving the rest of the inn's occupants alternately darting glances at them and staring wide-eyed at the dead beastmen on the floor, now twisted in their half-man, half-beast death rictus. All except for the old man, who had retrieved his pipe from the floor where he tossed it and, after looking at it with obvious amusement, clamped it, still unlit, back in his jaws. He stared thoughtfully at the dead beast man, then glanced over to the table in the corner. For a moment, the wrinkles melted from his face as he smiled. Then he frowned slightly and stared again at the dead creature, now rapidly crumbling to dust on the floor. If anyone had watched, they might have seen the youth that momentarily peeked from behind his aged countenance during that smile. No one had, however, and as the last of the changer's remains dispersed into the dirt of the floor, he sighed and closed his eyes, dozing again in the rickety chair beside the fire. Outside, the storm beat more fiercely than ever against the old inn, and the wind sent its chill howls into the winter darkness. The keening wind blew long and hard that bitter, frosty night, to pierce the heart and chill the bone and chase away the light. When in the blasted land it claimed, the darkness woke once more, to rend a battered world from which 'twas bound in time of yore. And that concludes our reading of Winter Night by me, Jared Michaud. I was your narrator, and in the cast we had
Chad as the old man.
Terry as the pack leader.
Mel as Talina.
Luke as Bretran.
Jared's oldest as Malachi.
Jared's second as Cirith.
John as Ulgoth.
Elijah as Grath.
Thank you all for joining me for the recording, cast members, and thank you everyone who's watching, listening. Appreciate you. Hope you enjoyed it, and we will catch you next time. Thank you.